Okay, thank you. Now, oh yes, you wanted to come in on this, Mohammed.
Yes, I totally agree with Dr. Grenier that, you know, the foreign policy is by and large an extension of domestic policy. The WhatsApp message is provocative, depending on how you look at it. And there are 2 points from the international order was from 1492. Built on a pattern of white supremacy, European and thus white supremacy, and the evolution of the international system has been in that light, and the international order functions again in the interest of the dominant and the powerful, who continue to remain the former colonizers and the U.S. And Canada, Australia, etc. Notwithstanding that, does that mean that we don't engage? We really don't have a choice. It's a matter of a existential battle. We, as developing countries, have to fight for our place and for what is rightfully ours. A lot of the times we are on the losing side, but the alternative is to merely give up. And if we look at the examples of all those who have fought, you know, from around the developing world and from minority communities in the larger, rich, former colonizing countries, if we were to give up what was their fight worth? And secondly, the U.S., Joe Biden is he's an establishment Democrat. We know his track record. We know his involvement in the crime bill from the 90s. We know what he is. You may argue that he has produced a very diverse cabinet in terms of race and gender, but you look at the people who and what they represent, and they're all establishment status quo Democrats, regardless of their color or their gender. You have people who are linked to you have a black Secretary of Defense, but he's a board of director of an arms manufacturer. We know where his interests will lie. So yes, you have, he came into power on the basis of being pushed by progressives to adopt a certain agenda. Will he live up to that agenda or not? It will depend on the constant pressure being placed on him. So I am not as willing to be so lenient with the Biden-Harris administration, because I know where the two of them come from, despite the portrayal of gender diversity, racial diversity.
Yeah.
Their interests and their track record speaks to a certain thing. They went along with a progressive agenda, and that was, pushed onto them rather than, I think, they honestly believing in it. And so it is up to progressives to continue to push them to live up to what they promised. But based on the US political system.
Here you are together at mealtime with music, a special moment.
Sorry about that.
Yeah,
go ahead.
So to finish off, we've seen, waves of hope previously in the US. But when you look at the US domestic situation, a lot of what pertained in the 1940s and the 1960s and the 1980s still continues to exist, despite all of the hope and all of the supposed change that was supposed to come with each person that promises change.
Thank you for that. We do have a slight divergence in opinions here. And I think one of the things I would like to bring to this is also and some of you did mention this towards the beginning, there tends to be a generally stable approach with respect to U.S. foreign policy, especially when it comes to this region. We have a WhatsApper who asks, what is the U.S.'s foreign policy approach to the Caribbean? We wanted to see the back of Trump, but what does that mean? right? So that is a question that is there. But we also have some callers on the line who I believe have been waiting for quite some time. So let's bring them into the conversation. Good afternoon. This is Brass Tack Sunday.
Good afternoon. A very enlightening discussion. I think that what Dr. Grenade said is not often told to the public, so I thought it was very useful of her to remind the public about the areas of CARICOM integration that we've achieved much progress. Now, the only thing that I would add to that is that it concerns me that we fail to demonstrate a higher level of cooperation in crisis moments, like, for example, the 2007-2008 global financial crisis, and now this crisis. So it concerns me that in the hard times, we need to advance as a collective, retreat on individual positions. And I wonder at times if it's because we believe that we cannot find regional solutions for our own common concerns within our own regional integration project. I would just leave that there. And I also agree with Dr. Grenade that it's too soon to say how the Biden administration will treat with us in the Caribbean. But I believe that now is the time we could seek a joint CARICOM approach that urges the U.S. administration to re-engage the CARICOM region. For me, unlike Biden's predecessor, Biden's mantra is about unity and respect for nations. And I think also with VP Kamala Harris there and her Caribbean roots, we might be able to broach a meeting to reinvigorate our relations with the U.S. Having said that, though, and this is despite the fact that we had Mike Pompeo just recently, just as recent as last year, between January 21st and the 22nd, meeting with some CARICOM countries and not with others. But I wanted to ask Alisa about the TRIPS agreement. That's the agreement that is related to aspects of intellectual property rights. I want to ask her, seeing that so many CARICOM countries have not been able to sign on to that agreement as it is, do you think that we have any clout in terms of asking for special considerations with respect to the pharmaceuticals, i.e. that is the vaccines and the vaccinations that will come out?
And I would add not just vaccines, but some of the emphasis might also be on the testing equipment and all sorts of things that also are quite expensive. But go ahead, let's hear from Ms. Nichols.
Okay, I thank you, Carla, for her points and the question. The TRIPS agreement, we are actually part of the TRIPS agreement because the TRIPS agreement is part of the package of agreements which fall under the WTO agreement. Right. So as WTO members, we also are part of the TRIPS agreement. What we are not part of as yet is part of the proposal that is being mooted by South Africa and India, which is still being discussed in the WTO right now and really has received opposition from many developed countries, and including the US at the time and Canada, and I think Canada, but let me pause there because I'm not too sure if Canada was one of the objectors, but the EU for sure. With regard to whether there's a need to suspend certain aspects of the TRIPS agreement, the protections for certain intellectual property rights during the time that the pandemic is going on, to allow developing countries access to the vaccines. It would be an interesting proposal for us to consider whether we should sign on to. I think that's something. I don't want to be deterministic and tell Caribbean countries what to do, because they have to sit down and assess whether it's in their own interest, whether they want to sign on to the proposal, and whether they think it will benefit them. But I think that it would be a useful proposal for our missions to consider whether we want to support within the WTO. That's the answer I could give on that.
Right. Okay. All right. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. You're most welcome. And thank you.
All right. We are approaching 1 o'clock and this program ends at 1:15. So I am going to use my privilege here as a moderator to ensure I get in this one question to you all. We are going to go back to the phone lines, but I want to get in a question that is kind of tangential to COVID-19 and U.S.-Caribbean relations. And this has to do with climate change. So climate change is something that is extremely important to this region that we live in, to Barbados. We've heard Prime Minister Motley repeatedly speak about this. We've also heard the prime ministers from Antigua and Barbuda, as well as St. Vincent and the Grenadines, speak about this on international platforms in very eloquent ways. And what we have seen is one of the first executive orders signed by President Biden was for the reentry of the United States of America into the Paris Climate Accord. And there are connections that we perhaps might want to make between addressing this global crisis that certainly has significant ramifications for the Caribbean if we are going to continue, well, first of all, to exist, to be able to do things, you know, a lot of things that we may take for granted today may be jeopardized by significant natural disasters, by things such as sea level rise, which is predicted and can also have implications for food security, agriculture, depending on what the nature of the sea level rise is, if it occurs, but also COVID-19. Because what we have with COVID-19 are these sort of reversals, as I mentioned previously, in our public finances and the fortunes of tourism. So how do you think this can affect us in the region, this reentry of the United States of America into the Paris Climate Accords? How does this augur for us in the region in terms of the future, not just thinking of this current moment, but going forward? Panelists.
If I may, Christina, please. I think this is a very positive development because global leadership is necessary in the fight in the climate crisis. Now, Caribbean and other small states were very instrumental, the small states in the Pacific and in the Caribbean, in sort of putting on the agenda, on the global agenda, the issue of climate change, whether it was in the Commonwealth or in the United Nations. And I am happy to see the United States having rejoined the Paris Accord. I think it's an opportunity for us in the Caribbean to again reinforce our interest in this area, because as you said, this is for the long haul and it is positive. And I think the United States has shown good intentions in this regard, and let's see where it goes. But we have to do our part to be at the table, continuing to dialogue, continuing to put the case of Caribbean countries, and not just Caribbean countries. This is an opportunity for South-South partnerships, for us to partner with other countries in the Pacific and other places in the world where we have common threats and common problems. So I think this is a resetting of the global agenda on climate change, and it is very positive that the United States is taking leadership in this area.
Thank you. Yes, Mohammed.
Yes, so climate change, environment, I'm very passionate about that. I write about it a lot. I've written about the Paris Agreement and et cetera. So I'll try to be very brief. Symbolically, the re-entry into the Paris Accords as one of his first acts is important symbolically. It demonstrates on the surface that, you know, they're committed to combating climate change. Practically, what does it mean? I don't think it means that much, because whether they're in the Paris Accord or out, for me, the Paris Accord is a farce. It's not a popular opinion, because we as humans need to believe in something and feel good and feel sentimental. The US was one of the main opponents of a strong, legally binding agreement that held countries to doing something meaningful about climate change, along with countries like Saudi Arabia, Australia, you know, the climate change deniers, some of them. So we have an accord that doesn't really do anything to fight climate change. The goals in it are not mandatory. Nobody has to do what they say they will do. There's nothing to make them do. There's no do it. There's no, you know, mechanism to for compliance. And the goals are already very, very weak. So what countries said they will do in 2015 was far, 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 far away from what was necessary. And 5 years down the line, nothing has progressed. We have now just gotten agreement on how we will implement goals that are already weak. That is the farce of this agreement. So entry or re-entry doesn't really matter. At the end of the day, in the negotiations, which I was present in, so I'm speaking, you know, from a perspective of an insider, the positions that the US exposes on climate change are generally the same, regardless of the administration. It depends. The message is conveyed in a different way. There's under the Democrats, there's a much more, there's a willingness to work, but red lines on what they will accept remain steady, and they don't change, and they are in line with corporate interests. So that is the reality we deal with. So yes, it's a symbolic gesture, but you know, there's so much more that needs to be done, and will we see it being done? Based on the past 25 years of negotiations at the international level on climate change and the state of the world and the repeated reports by scientists, I call me a cynic.
Well, one of the things that I think needs to be brought up here is that I know under the previous dispensation, which would have been the Kyoto Protocols, again, addressing climate change, very important to us in the region. As Dr. Grenade mentioned, we have been very active in this region along with the Pacific in noting how critical this is to our survival, the survival of all of the sectors that we rely on for employment of our people, for making incomes and the like. But one of the things that was mentioned or offered by states as a reason why they did not live up to their commitments was the global financial crisis. And now we're in this kind of crisis moment again that perhaps countries may put forward as a reason why they're not doing as much as they can do to address climate change. The difficulty that we may find with this is that although this current COVID-19 pandemic is a crisis, it does risk people's lives, their well-being, livelihoods, as we're often told, balancing lives and livelihoods. What happens if countries do not address this seriously, if they focus their energy, their resources, and all of this on COVID-19, and the planet still continues to warm, and we, as very vulnerable places, as island states, face the consequences of this? For me, I kind of disagree, because I think if the United States, even if their efforts will be somewhat modest, if they're involved in this global, and perhaps I am the opposite of the cynic, right? The eternal optimist. If they're involved in this, it still opens some space for them to be pushed in a particular direction that would possibly not be possible if they're outside. Dr. Grenade, Ms. Nichols? Yes, Alicia?
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Hines. I just wanted to weigh in here. I think I'm at the midway point between Dr. Grenade and Mr. Daigle on this issue. I think that leadership does matter. Having the world's, one of the world's largest emitters of greenhouse gases, being a part, again, of the Paris Agreement is important symbolically. But I agree, of course, with Mr. Daigle that there is a need, of course, for this to be matched in terms of domestic policy. So we know under the previous administration, there were many rollbacks over the admittedly very modest, in many cases, green initiatives that President Obama had done. But I do think that there is going to be a need on the part of the Biden administration, if they are serious, to have the sort of measures that will help reduce the USA's emissions. So things in terms of you know, standards for cars, etc. The problem, and I agree with Mr. Daigle on this, the problem with the Paris Agreement is the fact that, you know, it's really countries that determine you know, they set their own standards in terms of how they want to lower their emissions through their nationally determined contributions. So really and truly, there's nothing that's really compelling a country to be as ambitious as possible. It's really moral treaty, so to speak, as opposed to, you know, a legally binding solution. And let's face it, in international law, unless you're a small state, really and truly, it's not that easy to compel a state to do something in international law unless you're really a small state. Another thing I would add is that with regard to the Caribbean, I mean, and maybe I'm going to be a bit pessimistic here. I mean, we talk a good talk around the world talking about climate change, but what are we doing within our own region? I mean, I'm still seeing Caribbean futures being fueled on fossil fuels. I mean, I don't think we're doing enough to really encourage our people to choose energy efficient products. I mean, if I'm looking for any energy efficient fridge, for instance, I will still have to fork out much more money than a less energy efficient fridge, for instance. In terms of electric cars, those are still a lot more expensive than the gas guzzlers that we have here. You know, so it's one thing to talk the talk and to go around the world pointing our fingers at the developed countries and saying, look, you know, y'all are making things difficult for us. Y'all are, you know, ruining our futures. But if we ourselves are not doing enough to ensure that we are energy efficient, that we are reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. Yes, they're not in the realm of the developed countries, but at the same time, we still have to do our part to ensure that we encourage our people to choose less energy demanding products. Lastly, I think that at the end of the day, all of us have a role to play. So it's one thing for the governments. Yes, the government sets the tone, but we as individuals have to ensure that if we are serious about climate change, which we should be, we have to ensure that we choose the more climate friendly approach whenever we do anything. But again, that's not always easy if the incentive is more so towards the less energy efficient product or service.
Thank you for that. And I don't know if you all have seen some of these reports about masks and mask disposal and how the waste that is now being generated by disposable masks, and it is also showing up in our seas, oceans, causing another set of problems. So while we battle with one global crisis, there is another, and there are some intersections, even if it may not be front of mind. Dr. Grenade, did you want to say something else on this topic? This particular
No, not really. I'm mindful of the time and I don't know if there are other callers.
Okay, let's see if we can get another one last caller in before we have to go. Good afternoon. This is Brass Tack Sunday.
Good afternoon, Doctor, to you and your guest.
Good afternoon. Hello? Yes.
Yeah. I just want to make two comments very quickly. And the first one is that back in the first time, they had this big meeting at the UN, United Nations, where all the Caribbean leaders were there talking about how beautiful their country are, who has the sweetest coconuts, who has the prettiest beaches and all that kind of thing. And that told me from that time that there will never be regional integration in this country, all we talk and try. But for the panelists now, I want to ask them this. I want to know if they're going to tell me anything, because I hear them talking all kinds of things. But I want them to comment on all of those thousands of little children in Houston and other parts of America that was separated from the children. I wanted to comment on that. Tell me what anything Biden will do. Thank you.
All right. Thank you as well. Does anyone, I don't know how our panelists would know what Biden will do, but any insights, panelists? I did see a commitment to rectifying the situation, but I don't know how the panelists would know. Any insights? Inside track from the panelists?
You can't speak to that authoritatively. There has been sentiments expressed that they will reduce the harm caused by what Trump did. But what a lot of people don't remember is that the separation and that didn't start under Trump. He intensified it and took it to grotesque levels, but that was an Obama-era policy. So we will have to see what Biden does. He has some of his executive actions dealt with immigration. But the other thing that must be borne in mind is that the amount of destruction caused by Trump will take a lot of time to reverse. And while Biden may have intentions or plans, a lot of what has to be done to dismantle the harm caused by Trump will undertake a lot of work and will be fought tooth and nail, including within the court system, by the Republicans. So you won't see change overnight either.
Okay, thank you. So we're just about to wrap up. There were some other questions that I had to ask you, but this discussion has been so engaging. I was really interested to find out what you think as a panelist about the vaccination plans in the United States of America, also the COVID relief package being proffered by the Biden administration, and what this may mean, for instance, in the United States of America for people having more money in their pockets, being better able to get back to work and some semblance of normalcy, and the reverberations this might have in the region in terms of people feeling comfortable to resume things such as leisure tourism. And also, this is a region where we are heavily dependent on remittances. So if our brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, family members, or whoever in the United States of America are more comfortable, able to get back to work and to some semblance of normalcy, what this may mean for us. So I am going to ask you, I don't know if you can give us some insight on that in your closing words, but I'll ask each of you for closing thoughts on today's session. And if you feel to address in some way that final point I made, you are free to do so. So let us begin with Dr. Grenade. Closing thoughts, just about a minute each, please.
Yes, thanks, Christina.
You're welcome.
For affording me the opportunity to be part of this panel, and thanks to my fellow panelists and for all of you who would have wrote in questions via the WhatsApp or listened or called in. I think it was a very engaging discussion, and the question of the United States and the Caribbean in a COVID-19 moment, it's a very significant one. And Christina, you summed it up well, because many of us have relatives in the United States. What happens in the United States, how the COVID-19 pandemic is managed, of course, would have direct implications for us. The United States is our largest trading partner. It's a major source market. We have families, relatives there in terms of remittance flows. So it's important for us, even as we seek to understand what is happening in our own locale, what happens in the United States, not just from a foreign policy perspective, but in terms of people-to-people connectivity. If this is managed well, there are positive implications for us, and vice versa. So I really want to thank you for putting this panel together. I think it has given us a lot to think about in terms of how we go forward, how we reset the world in the post-COVID-19 period, what it means for communities, for countries, for the international community in terms of global leadership. And I really want to wish all of Barbados well as we go into this week of national pause. For those of you who may be feeling uncertain and fearful, we have to always remember that there is hope, and we have to be hopeful. There will be light at the end of the tunnel. So thanks to all of you, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you, Dr. Grenade, Mr. Dega, and then Alicia, very quickly, closing thoughts.
Yes, thank you to all of you. You know, it has been a really engaging conversation, and I didn't realize the time, you know, flew by so quickly. Just very quickly, I'll speak, you know, in economic terms, which everybody can, you know, humans, we think in terms of our economic situation. We are so closely tied with the US and with the rest of the world because of our open economy, that our economic prospects are very contingent on the US turning this COVID situation around. So, you know, I just hope and pray, despite what is happening and the constraints, that there can be some measure of success in the short term and further into the long term, because it has an impact on all of us, and that specifically in terms of U.S. Caribbean and U.S. Barbados relations.
Thank you. Alicia Nichols, final word?
Final word is that I'll just endorse what my fellow panelists have said. It has been a really great discussion. Time goes fast when you're having fun, isn't it? So thank you, fellow panelists. Thank you, Dr. Hines. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. And thank you all of our listeners who gave us some very interesting thoughts to consider.
Thank you. Thank you, panelists. I wish everyone a wonderful week ahead as you prepare for this national pause. This has been Brass Tack Sunday. I am Dr. Christina Hines, and I thank you, Mr. Johnson, for so ably, as always, producing this program. Good afternoon.